Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by Tegan Goddard of Political Wire. How are you, sir?
Hi, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, you know, this is one of those days where I'm making the notes of things to talk about. I want to talk about your new electoral college map, because I have questions. I have questions about all of that. But I'm just going to throw this out without giving you any preparation whatsoever. What is by far the coolest story today, do you think?
The coolest story today.
What do you think is the coolest story?
Well, I mean, I think that Julian Assange is probably the most interesting story today. I don't know if it's the coolest, but it is certainly interesting that how Ecuador has finally gotten sick of Julian Assange and has found a way to boot him out of the embassy, and he was promptly arrested. And it's interesting, of course, because the politics of this in the United States are so incredibly different. There was a time when the left in America embraced Julian Assange, and that seemed to completely reverse itself when Donald Trump, during the 2016 campaign, embraced Julian Assange. And
I love WikiLeaks. I love them.
141 times, Charlie, he said that. But now we're in a situation where everyone's kind of distancing themselves. And I guess if you did not want to be one person in the world right now, it's probably Julian Assange.
Yeah, no. By the way, I love the president when he was asked about, "Do you still love WikiLeaks?" I have no idea. Who are they? I've never heard of it. It's not my thing. And of course, this means that all of the networks and everybody in podcasts are coming up with all of the mixes of all the times he cited, how wonderful WikiLeaks was. It is going to be interesting watching the ideological flip. This story is fascinating. I mean, I have other fascinating stories, but apparently they just got, I mean, I assume there's high diplomacy and all kinds of explanations how the new leaders of Ecuador, perhaps wanted to wipe this off their shoes and restore their relationship with the United States. But also just the fact that it turns out they just got sick of all of his bad habits, that he objected to having to clean up his own bathroom. I mean, I don't know. Well, I think there's cat-related issues, and you could just tell that he was sort of not into cleanliness, and he probably was just a pain in the ass to have around the embassy.
Well, Charlie, the 3-day rule for house guests, he extended that to about 7 years, so that's probably he probably wore out his welcome. But there's actually an interesting story in the Daily Beast, which talks about what actually may have been the final straw for Ecuador. Which was that he posted, or WikiLeaks posted, stolen emails from the inboxes of Ecuador's president and first lady. I mean, right there, I think, is not the smartest move in the world if you want to stay in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Yeah, who knows? Andrew Egger has a piece up on our website, The Bulwark. Andrew, who I think he's been wrong about Bill Barr, is absolutely right about Julian Assange. And he points out there's no great need to rehash Assange's life story other than to say that he is an odious fool whose arrogance in service of a cockamamie ideology helped him do a great deal of damage to America and its intelligence sources abroad as a witting tool of the world's most evil regimes. As the curtain is pulled back, however, this may be a helpful moment to dispense with the final vestiges of the fantasy of Julian Assange as some sort of an online Robin Hood. That's just good. It's just so brilliant. Okay, I love that story. I also am slightly obsessed with the whole black hole thing. and by the way, I'm going to get to Michael Avenatti in a moment because of course you can't resist making these completely pointless connections, but this. But you've obviously seen this picture, like everybody, because it's on the front page of every paper in the world. That it's 6.5 billion times the mass of the sun. It's amazing. About the size of our solar system. It's 62 billion miles across. I mean, it's just this thing is 55 million light years away in the constellation Virgo. And you know what all those numbers have in common? I have no idea what they mean. There's no space in my head to comprehend what we're talking about here, except that there it is. We now have a picture of a black hole, which is going to be the most overstressed metaphor in the world. Because speaking of, and I'm not going to say what it looks like, but speaking of that, I flew here from, I'm in Austin, Texas right now. I just got off a plane from San Francisco. And when I'm up in the air, I'm reading the actual Justice Department complaint against Michael Avenatti. I don't know if you've had a chance to do this, Tegan, but
I did, yes.
Oh, my God. This guy, you want to talk about a grifter and a crook. I mean, there's no vagueness about it, that the guy gets these clients. He gets settlements for them, which is, hey, you know, good job there. And then he doesn't tell them he has the settlement. He pockets the money, and he lulls them, and he makes up all of these bullshit stories about, yeah, we can't get you the money or anything. And they have this over and over and over again. But my actual favorite part of all of this is looking at his Twitter feed. The guy has retweeted him. And he deleted the tweet because I actually said sort of Alexa define chutzpah and shamelessness. He is still the fighter for good. That's the way he describes himself, the fighter for good. But, you know, the thing about Michael Avenatti, it's one of those moments where you have to ask once again, how did someone like this become so prominent in our politics and our culture? I mean, it's like, you got the Julian Assanges and you got the Michael Avenattis. Although Julian Assange, you know, frankly looks like Mahatma Gandhi compared to Michael Avenatti. But I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember when people were saying, well, you know what? He's the Democrats' Donald Trump. Turns out he's a lot more Trumpian than anybody had any idea.
Well, it's probably why he understood Michael Cohen so well, right? I mean, he was probably engaged in much of the same. But, you know, the noise you hear across America right now, of course, is Democrats just thinking that he's not actually running for president in the Democratic primary like he had attempted to do a few months ago. What a nightmare that would have been, right?
Oh, God. Well, no, it would have been entertaining. He would have been, the 89th candidate who's running. Speaking of which, I see a new poll out in Iowa. There's a bunch of new polls out showing that Joe Biden is still ahead. Has anybody coined the term Pete Mentum yet? it's terrible. It'll only have a shelf life of about like 2 days, but
yeah, that's not going to catch on, Charlie. It really is. Yeah. There was a poll yesterday in New Hampshire that had Mayor Pete running in third behind Biden and Sanders, and today a Monmouth poll comes out in Iowa, which has Mayor Pete again running in third, and he's ahead of some very solid Democratic politicians: Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, I mean, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker. I mean, these are all senators who've raised $5, $6, $7, $8 million. You know, Bernie Sanders, who's raised, $19 million or whatever, is really just only a few points ahead in these polls. And Mayor Pete is just kind of running up on the outside. And it's been interesting watching his strategy. And I contrast him a little bit with Beto O'Rourke. Beto O'Rourke has pretty much been absent from television. He's not doing interviews. Mayor Pete is kind of doing it the old-fashioned way. He's going on Meet the Press. He's going on, as many of these television shows as he can. And he knows that it's a medium that works well for him. He's, he comes across as a very, good-thinking, mild-mannered guy who just wants to roll up his shirt sleeves and get things done. And he becomes a perfect contrast to Donald Trump in so many ways. And I think Democrats are slowly jumping on board his train.
Yeah, and he is saying things that are interesting. I mean, he says things that are somewhat unexpected. He's going in places that the other candidates aren't going, talking about his faith and what it's like being an openly gay man. And he does actually, as opposed to most of the other guys who you sort of feel that you put a quarter in and you get the talking points. Mm-hmm. But, this race does seem like there's going to be a lot of folks who are, big hat, no cattle in terms of like lots of money, but no votes, in places like New Hampshire. I do think it's interesting that I mentioned this in the podcast yesterday with Tim Miller, that with all of the kerfuffle around how handsy Joe Biden was, there's no indication that that's hurting him in the polls at all. But speaking of those polls, there is a dramatic an age gap on the Democratic side. You look at voters over 45 and they love Joe Biden. You look at voters under 45 and they're all in for Bernie. guess if I had to choose, I'd go for the over 45 voters, but that's just me.
Yeah, no, it is. It's fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating that the oldest guy in the race, Bernie Sanders, is the most appealing so far to young people, although it is really early. And so we're in a situation where, you know, so if you talk about Mayor Pete and he's going through using this very traditional strategy of doing mainstream media appearances to try to build up his name recognition, the missing piece of his campaign so far, really, although he did have a video clip go viral yesterday, is that social media component that someone like Beto O'Rourke is really only using. He's only on social media and he's raising tons of money using that, but he's not willing to subject himself to, you know, at this point, to a meet the press interview or something like that. It is interesting watching them do that, but I really do think that if Buttigieg, if he gets to the point where, you know, he has like a viral clip that he had yesterday when he, or over the weekend when he was criticizing Mike Pence's views of his sexuality and that type of thing. That's the type of thing that could really start to change this field, and it can start to, you know, pull some of that younger support away from a guy like Bernie Sanders, because he is very appealing to a wide swath of the Democratic primary vote. The way that I look at the Democratic primary is there's only, you know, 20 years, there's only been one man who's been one Democrat has been elected president, and he did it with a coalition of young voters, of women, and of minorities. And if you look at this race, that's really the coalition that Democrats need to put back together again. And so you look at each of these candidates, who can put that together again? And you look at a guy like Bernie Sanders. Well, he seems very appealing to young people, but to people of color, not so much. He's trying different strategies to appeal to those voters, but, you know, not so much in terms of his track record. You know, someone like Joe Biden, you know, doesn't really have young people, but he's appealing to, you know, he appeals to women, believe it or not, despite the controversies. Women support him, you know, in large numbers. And Mayor Pete is one of these candidates where it's not clear yet. You know, he's so new on the scene. We'll see what happens. But it'll be interesting to see who can put that coalition back together, if anyone.
Yeah, the Bernie thing, I have to admit, it still surprises me that if you're a young voter, you look at Bernie Sanders and you go, yes, that's my vision of the future, when they have so many other choices. I mean, you want another progressive, you go with Elizabeth Warren. You want somebody who is, you know, is more exciting. You know, you go with somebody like Beto. But the Bernie Sanders, and I'm not sure that Bernie Sanders is going to wear well on the campaign trail. I'm just not sure that he's had the scrutiny on his. Just his demeanor and the way he handles himself. So we'll see. Another Pew poll out, since we're talking polls here. I noticed this new survey on the gender gap, telling us something that we all knew, that there's a massive gender gap, not just on Donald Trump, but on views of government. But these numbers are interesting, that they find that Trump's approval disapproval number among men is 47-47, and among women, 32% approve, 63% disapprove.
It's unbelievable. It's like something we've never seen before, right?
Apparently, you can't grab them. It doesn't work. I mean, I don't know who knew.
Who knew, right? Who knew? But that's, you know, and again, that's why, you know, this coalition, women being one key component that Obama used to win the presidency twice, that's going to be very important for Democrats. So, you look at someone like Kamala Harris. Well, theoretically, she would appeal to women. You know, theoretically, she might appeal to people of color. At this point, though, she hasn't really made inroads with those younger voters. And look, it's super early. And when people talk about Bernie Sanders and his appeal to young voters, I think you raise a good point, Charlie, which is that despite raising all of this money, despite having, you know, name recognition that's through the roof, he's still sitting here in Iowa with this poll at 16%. And, you know, in Joe Biden, you know, running, you know, 11 points ahead of him. So, you know, the fact that Bernie's out there is a known quantity. He can raise money from, you know, from this, you know, big mailing list that he's got. He's still actually sitting only at 16%. So I think your observation that, you know, in a field this diverse, I think that a lot of people, as some of these other candidates are more well known, Mayor Pete, possibly Beto O'Rourke, you know, possibly even someone like Cory Booker, I see some of that support, you know, gravitating away from Bernie. And actually, Joe Biden, if he gets in the race, you know, in the next few days or later this month, as he's expected to, you know, that may be his best day in the race, because then it's a dogfight to the end.
So let's talk about the electoral college map that you put up. Really interesting. I guess what really strikes me is how few states are really in play.
Yeah. So, you know, what I thought of doing, you know, I've been running Political Wire now, Charlie, for over 20 years, and which is a lifetime in the internet when it comes to the internet.
Several lifetimes.
When it came to looking at the 2020 election, obviously with Donald Trump having won the electoral vote but not the popular vote, I thought that there was going to be a renewed attention to the Electoral College, which, of course, we've seen, you know, in recent days. We've seen a number of candidates call for abolishing the Electoral College. In any event, I thought it would be a very useful thing to have an extremely clean and easy way for people to play around with an interactive electoral map. So the site is at electoralvotemap.com, and what the front page will do is it will show a consensus forecast at this point, and there's been three of them that have come up. And as you mentioned, there's only really a handful of states that are kind of in that toss-up category, seven of them, really. We can go through the big three, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which are the ones that, you know, that blue wall that Trump breached in 2016. And those are going to be key states, obviously, if the Democrats think they're going to win. But then, so that's those are the Rust Belt states. And then there's the Sun Belt states. And you can think of those as Arizona, Florida, which are the kind of the two potential toss-ups, maybe North Carolina. And then maybe even throw in possibly, although I'm a little skeptical, Texas or Georgia, which could be in play. And then you could see Democrats, you could see at least some Democrat suggesting maybe a Sun Belt strategy might be better than the Rust Belt strategy.
Right now on your map, the only ones that you don't have shaded in are, as you mentioned, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Arizona. Surprise for me was you put Florida as a toss-up. Last year, good year for Republicans in a Democratic way. Why would you think that Florida is still a toss-up state?
Well, it's not just me, and this is a consensus forecast, which is not coming just from me. It's coming from, you know, Charlie Cook at the Cook Political Report, Inside Elections, and Larry Sabato. What this is it's a way to take these three forecasts that have already come out and to average them, essentially. You know, like we average polls all the time.
Yeah.
And so what these early forecasts are suggesting is that Florida will actually be a toss-up again. And, you know, we're still a ways out, and we need to look at a number of factors like Donald Trump's approval rating in each of these states. We need to look at head-to-head polling matchups, you know, later on in the cycle when they start coming up. But it is at least a time to get people to start thinking about this. And so, look, Charlie, you might be right. 2018 showed the Republicans doing quite well in Florida, considering there was a blue wave. Without Florida, that Sun Belt strategy I talked about for Democrats, that may not be viable.
Right.
Maybe the Rust Belt strategy is the only real strategy, where between Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, Donald Trump won those three states by a combined 80,000 votes. Maybe that's the strategy that will actually allow a Democrat to actually beat Donald Trump in 2020. Yeah. But, you know, I think that if that, you know, if we come down to the 2020 election and it's down to three states, that will be one of the oddest presidential elections we've ever had, where all the campaigning really just takes place in a handful of states.
And that's really conceivable when you look at this map. You can really imagine that happening.
You definitely could.
There's a lot. Now, of course, you also have Arizona as being a toss-up, which is very interesting because, of course, Democrats did very well there in 2018. But that's one of those states that Republicans are always – I mean, Democrats are always fantasizing about flipping in a presidential race. They never quite get there, but it does seem that that's near a tipping point. So that's interesting because then you're talking about – Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, all going to the Democrats, which again is an interesting development. Well, let's talk about, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And I I completely agree that that's going to be where the election is going to be decided. And the issue set that's going to play there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and you know, none of this stuff is groundbreaking, but the suburban vote that you know had been Republican that's been trending Democratic is going to play a huge role in all of that. But those are the states that also explain why Democrats for more than a decade had stayed away from certain issues like gun control because of the way they play in rural Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, throw in Ohio and Minnesota as well. And there was a conventional wisdom among Democrats that we probably should dial that back because that plays that there's a terrible issue in states like that. That doesn't appear to be the case in this strategy. And I wonder how this electoral, you know, the need to crack this electoral code is going to match up with the issue set that the Democrats appear to be embracing.
It's a very good point. I think what they're hoping for is that there will be enough enough positions that Donald Trump has taken that actually are not, you know, do not play very well in these states. You know, maybe, you know, such things as tariffs or, you know, positions on health care or really having no health care strategy at all. I think that that may be something that that Democrats are hoping for. We're obviously Republicans have the great advantage of being of watching the Democrats try to win a nomination, and winning a nomination is very different, as you know, than running in the general election. And issues such as gun control are going to be very helpful to most Democrats running for the nomination. And as you said, they might not be as helpful when it comes to the general election. But Donald Trump has taken enough positions, I think, that will hurt him in those states than will help him in those states. And I don't think that, you know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe guns is the issue of the 2020 presidential election. Somehow I think that healthcare will be a bigger issue for.
Okay. Well, I think the poll numbers would indicate that healthcare will be. And of course, this raises the question. I'm watching Bernie Sanders roll out his Medicare for All, which is going to be very, very popular among Democrats. And there appears to be kind of a jailbreak of Democrats in embracing that. But I guess the question is, in a general election, when people put price tags on that, when they start talking about, you know, $30 trillion for Medicare for All and the possibility of eliminating all private insurance, I wonder how that plays. I mean, both of these parties, I think, have taken positions of significant risk. I mean, the Republicans are out there trying to wipe out Obamacare with nothing to replace it. You know, in a normal world, that would make it a huge advantage for the Democrats. But going for something as disruptive as Medicare for All, there's a long political history of don't mess with people's health care. Don't be the one who looks like you're going to take something away from folks. So I'm not sure how that plays out in a general election.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that there are some of the Democratic candidates who are trying to use the overall term Medicare for All, and they're trying to have it mean multiple things in this primary. Medicare for All could mean simply a public option, you know, under Obamacare. And some people are suggesting that, you know, we should at least make that available to all, but not obviously get rid of private insurance. And I think there are some Democrats who are trying to have it both ways, a little bit like they are, you know, on the Green New Deal, where we can talk about, you know, this proposal, you know, by, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, mm-hmm. which if you start putting price tags to this legislation, it looks absurd. But then you have senators like Amy Klobuchar who say, look, I back it. I'm a co-sponsor of it because it's aspirational. It's where we want to go. And I think this may be an election, and it's going to help with Donald Trump as the other candidate. This may be an election where policy specifics really just get lost. And, you know, Donald Trump is certainly not one who's going to, you know, add up price tags on things. And if he does, few people are going to believe him because none of that really ever comes true. And the Democrats may follow their lead on that. You know, Hillary Clinton, many Democrats thought that she got too hung up on what things would cost that she was proposing, which is why she wouldn't endorse, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know, community college for, you know, free community college for everybody, because she was worried about what it would cost. And so some Democrats think that was a mistake. and that she should have just embraced the vision of that and worried about the rest later, because that's certainly what Donald Trump did, and he ended up winning.
Yeah, no, this is something for a wonk like me to remind myself of, because I think one of the lessons we've learned about politics is that it's not always about policies and about ideas and about the practical implications of who's going to pay for the wall, et cetera, that our politics is really much more attitudinal. It's much more a matter of identity. And so painting in broad pastels may actually be the way to do it. The people are just going to say, we're going to vote for you because we like you, and really we're not going to ask about the math. But you mentioned free college, and I will remember one story from the 2016 election that really stuck with me. And by the way, I want to confess once again, I didn't see Trump winning in Wisconsin and or Michigan or Pennsylvania at all, except that there were a couple of indications. And I was talking with a guy who's a Republican congressman from Wisconsin, who's a very savvy observer of voters. And he was up at a meeting in the fall of 2016 of farmers. I think the crowd was, people in the agricultural community. And there was a Democratic state senator who was expected to win easily, and she was pushing the idea of free college education. And he was looking around the room and watching all these farmers and watching how they were repelled by the idea. Yeah, because in their mind, they're thinking, we have all of these economic problems. This does not address our economic problems. Now you're asking us to pay for somebody else's kid to go and get a degree in French flower arranging or whatever. And he said, at that moment, I thought, you know what? I think this woman could lose this election. This issue is not playing well. And in fact, it's backfiring hugely in these rural areas. And I assume if it was playing that way in rural Wisconsin, it might play that way in rural Pennsylvania and rural Ohio and rural Michigan as well. But I haven't seen a lot of commentary about that some of those things that seem appealing generate their own backlash, and we live in an age of negative partisanship where sometimes the most important issue is the one that just pisses off the other side, and that they come out because they hate it.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we see that with Trump and the wall and immigration generally. I think that he's not taking these positions, and he's not being so hardline on these positions to try to attract, Democratic votes or votes in the center. He's appealing directly to his base. He's trying to, rile them up. And I think, though, that education, while it may not, free education or I don't think free education is going to be the issue of the 2020 race, but issues like that for Democrats are what get young people perhaps to the polls. There are issues that, healthcare is something that gets suburban women to the polls. It is, that type of thing. I think we're long past the days. You go back to the 1990s, really, when we're talking about, soccer moms and NASCAR dads,
right.
These swing voters who don't seem to exist anymore. Instead, the divisions seem much deeper. The Trump years have only made them wider. You talk about this gender gap that's developed here. And, as a result, the strategies just don't work the same way. So, maybe that a free education plan, stolen from Bernie Sanders isn't going to work for the Democratic candidate among those rural voters, but maybe it will get the urban voters in those three states out to the polls.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, you don't know, and it is a matter of it is interesting in Wisconsin, for example, watching the rural areas become increasingly Republican, while the suburban areas have become less Republican. So, and there is kind of a replacement factor. One of the stories that I was going to mention earlier in the podcast. This is the great thing about podcasts. It's like unlike cable television or something, where you have 3 minutes, and then if you forget to say something, you remember it in the car on the way home. In a podcast, you can go back and say, "Hey, I forgot I wanted to talk about this." We keep looking for this moment when Republicans in the Senate or in the House are willing to push back against Donald Trump, and we've had about 150 false alarms, like, well, this will be it, this will be the turning point. Instead, the Lindsey Graham effect, where guys that you never thought were going to go all in. But before we began talking, I see that Herman Cain's nomination to the Federal Reserve apparently has gone up in flames. Kevin Cramer, senator from Republican from North Dakota, became the fourth Republican to say that he's not going to vote for Herman Cain. And what made this, I think that's interesting in and of itself, but it was also interesting that we heard that Mitch McConnell was going out and telling Republicans, hey, if you want to scuttle these nominations, speak out before they're made, that they actually have a strategy of, like, how do you kill a bad Trump appointment? You don't wait for it to come down and make it an up or down vote. And so you can see that sort of Mitch McConnell gave a green light to members of his caucus to go after this. And also the willingness of Republicans in the Senate to criticize the president for the way he's handling the Department of Homeland Security. This is kind of an interesting moment, isn't it? Without getting ahead of ourselves and thinking that there's going to be signs of, you know, green sprouts of independence or anything crazy like that.
Yeah, no, it's too early for that. But the issue is, so Homeland Security obviously is one where the same pushback that you're seeing to Herman Cain's nomination or even Stephen Moore's nomination to the Federal Reserve Board, you're seeing that same pushback from Kris Kobach or Ken Cuccinelli,
yeah, right,
as two names that have been floated to lead Homeland Security. You're seeing that. We've seen actually for months that pushback over Trump's auto tariffs. You add this all up and, you know, there's a little bit of optimism that Senate Republicans might actually try to take control of some of this. It's early, though, and, you know, there are still plenty of other things. I mean, I think Mitch McConnell, he's pretty savvy. He's kept his eye on the ball. You know, he's pretty much focused on nominations to the courts. And it's all about judges for him. He realizes with Nancy Pelosi in the House that hoping for some other types of legislation is highly unlikely to happen in the next 2 years. And so he's really focused on those nominations, and he doesn't want distractions such as, more controversial nominations to Homeland Security or the Fed to derail that. So he's pretty wise in trying to get senators to talk to Trump himself. But as we've seen, you know, people have been going to Trump privately on Homeland Security, at least within the White House, over the last few weeks, and that did not end well for any of them, Kirstjen Nielsen being one of them. And so we'll see how much of this pushback the president's willing to tolerate.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. It's also interesting the willingness of Republicans to criticize now Mick Mulvaney's still acting, right? He's still acting White House chief. He's not a real chief of staff, but very clearly he has a different approach than his predecessors, and I think might explain a little bit of the willingness of Republicans to push back, because he's not popular. I mean, you have guys like Shelby are going on the record dissing him and the role that he played. So you have a chief of staff who, I mean, Reince Priebus, for all of his flaws, and he certainly had many of them, really worked hard to try to create open diplomatic relations between Congress and the president. That doesn't appear to be Mick Mulvaney's strategy. I mean, and the whole letting Trump be Trump, you know, may feel good, but I'm not exactly sure that it's the formula for effective government.
Oh, no, I don't think it has anything to do about effective government. This is all about 2020 and in whipping up Trump's base. And Mulvaney may be playing a role on that. But you're right. If it backfires in the Senate and Trump has a few nominations blow up in his face because Republicans won't get on board, then, that could be a problem for him. I think your instincts are exactly right. Much of this pushback was tied with the last 3 or 4 months that Mulvaney has been in there as chief of staff or acting chief of staff.
Well, you know, looking on the bright side, maybe that gigantic black hole will just suck us all in before 2020, and the sweet meteor of death will make all of this moot. Who knows?
I was waiting for you to bring the metaphor up, Charlie.
I had to. That's the clean version of the metaphor I was thinking of. Tegan Goddard, thank you so much for joining me. You can read his stuff over at Political Wire, and the map.
It's at electoralvotemap.com.
Electoralvotemap.com. Yes. Definitely bookmark that. Thank you for spending time with me today. I appreciate it very much.
It's a pleasure, Charlie, and I really enjoy The Bulwark and your podcast as well. Awesome.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to The Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes.